America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in, and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. The new Spider-Man No Way Home film perfectly frames the conversation we'll have on this podcast about the Chinese using their market size and economic importance to seek changes in films to meet their own political objectives. In this case, the Chinese Communist Party wanted Sony Pictures to delete the Statue of Liberty from a crucial scene in the film. When Sony balked, the Chinese asked to minimize one of the world's most identifiable symbols of freedom. There are many instances like this, where the Chinese are using their growing market share to censor content. They've been fascinated with the soft power advantages and cultural opportunities America has gained through its movie industry. And while building their own, they want to dull the impact of our culture on their increasingly locked down society. It's a fascinating topic that we explore today here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Eric Schwartzell, and he's written a remarkable book called Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. And Eric, what I think is so fascinating about this topic is that this has been the movie industry, the whole idea of American culture. It has been really the greatest export, call it soft power, if you will, of the 20th century. Many people around the globe wanted to be like America. And yet in your book, what you're pointing to is a trend that has been going on for some time in Hollywood to try to accede to the cultural needs and demands of China, which we really are pitted against in so many ways.
You're absolutely right. It's a fascinating kind of new chapter in Hollywood history, certainly for the first, let's say, 100 years of the American entertainment industry. You're right. It was the dominant cultural export. It was the most powerful cultural medium, arguably, ever. It was pervasive, and also, even in the early days, this was something that I was struck by when I was researching the book, even in the early days, there was a sense that it would function as something of an arm of the American government. Even in the 1920s, officials in D.C. would refer to Hollywood as an adjunct of the State Department, because they knew that it had that soft power. There's another phrase that I really turn to quite frequently, which is political scientists said that Hollywood and other forms of soft power turned America into a, quote, empire by invitation. And you're right that I think, especially through the 80s with the Cold War, even relatively recently after September 11th, there was an expectation that Hollywood was becoming a global product, but still an American business. And I think that is one thing that China's influence on Hollywood really challenges, because China now is the number one box office in the world. America is not, and has very specific rules on what those stories can explore.
And that is a little stunning. I mean, as much as our movie industry may well have been thought of as that soft power extender, if you will, of America's reach across the globe, I mean, we've had many controversial films that any government official would not want to see because of what they say. So whether, in fact, there was any censorship of any sort, meaning self-censorship, where you say, well, I just don't know, how this will go down. Will the American public like it, because we're very critical of the American government? I doubt that has been a great consideration with all the anti-war films coming out of Vietnam and such. When our government makes a mistake, we hope that the movie industry, as well as others in the field of communication, will share that with us.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, how many movies do we go see and it's revealed at the end that the CIA was the yeah. culprit, or the vice president was in on it? That is a tried and true device, to say nothing of the movies that are made about critical moments in American history, you know, whether it's torture in the Middle East or, as you said, Vietnam certainly has been mined over and over again for movies about America's failure there. And I think that is one of the key differences between how Americans see the movies and how the Chinese see the movies. Because in China, the art has, especially since Mao Zedong's revolution, art has always been reflective of the state and will always serve the state. And so there would never be a movie about a Chinese Communist Party official who's exposed for corruption. And even if there is any, even if there's a story of corruption at all, it has to take place in a time before the CCP was in charge. Because if the CCP is in charge, there is not going to be any corruption. So there's this absolute mirroring of, I wouldn't say mirroring actually, let's say there's this kind of aspirational relationship between the government and the movies. The movies are supposed to reflect what the government wants society to look like, whereas in the U.S. it seems the movies have become oftentimes a place where we look for those, that critical airing of pushback or concerns.
And of course it moves our society forward. When we see a film about injustice to African Americans in America, you know, there is a greater understanding. A lot of people don't read a lot of books in this country, but they see a lot of films. And so we use it also to move us in different directions, whereas the Chinese want to move people lockstep through their own cultural maze that they have developed. I think it's so interesting. There's so much in this book that is fascinating to read, and I think it's going to be surprising to many. For example, you go back to 2008, and Chinese executives came to Hollywood to learn about the American film industry, because we are the leader of that, and China wanted to recreate that achievement at home. What secrets did we share with them, and how well did China learn those lessons?
They learned them better than anyone could have ever expected. The scene you're referencing, which was is one of those scenes that when you come across as an author, you just can barely believe your luck, was a moment in 2008 when a group of Chinese officials came over to UCLA to sit in a classroom and just essentially receive a series of guest lectures from studio executives, agents, officials from the Motion Picture Association, coming in and basically giving a little bit of a masterclass on how Hollywood works, how you put a movie together, how you distribute it, how you market it. And at the time, I think there was just a kind of, you know, there was certainly a greater sense of collaboration, not just between Hollywood and Chinese business, but also between the two countries. This is right around the time of the Summer Olympics in Beijing, so certainly a moment where there's optimism that there could be some kind of reform coming to China, maybe a better integration of China into the global economy and the mm-hmm. and the world order. And so the so this classroom experiment, if you will, has Chinese executives as the students and Hollywood or American executives as the teachers. And what was surprising to learn as I was reporting the book was just how, from those early days, Chinese executives would be able to export their culture around the world in something of a sequel to what Hollywood had done for America. And it started gradually, but it happened in very pragmatic ways. I mean, there was a question I had when I started writing this book, which was, you know, technology transfer is easy to understand when it's something like airplane blueprints, but how do you transfer storytelling? And it turns out that sometimes it's a matter of hiring the right stunt choreographer or the right sound mixer, hiring those people who whose work and craftsmanship can often elevate a film or elevate the feeling of a movie. There were other times when screenwriters would go over to China and punch up scripts and say, well, you know, actually it would do you a real favor if the hero like had a, you know, wisecrack here or a little bit of a quip, or why don't we even introduce something of a romance in the third act? That was happening as well. And over time, China's film industry and its output grew much more commercial. And so instead of just seeing government-sanctioned propaganda features at the multiplex, you started to see movies that look a lot like what the Americans have put out for decades, which are, you know, family comedies, dramas, science fiction films, that kind of thing.
Well, how good is the product, before we get into some of the business implications and the implications for the way movies are made, as we think, for the American audience, but in many ways they are in some way manufactured to fit many different purposes, including something that is no longer a luxury, and that is getting into these international markets like China. But how good are their movies?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think it's difficult to really assess from Western eyes, because storytelling in the Chinese style can be very different. You know, Eastern traditions of storytelling, mythology that differ from the West. So sometimes when you're watching a Chinese film as someone who grew up mostly watching American films, it can feel different, or like it's hard to quite get your bearings. I will say that it certainly seems like there's been a real concerted effort to improve, I don't know how quite to put this, but to improve the feel of a film. And so that means just making sure that the special effects are more sophisticated and that the sound is sharper. Those kinds of things are certainly improving. I think that the bigger gap, though, is A, there are still narrative differences between the Western storytelling mode and the Eastern storytelling mode. And also, I think there's still oftentimes something of a cultural gap too, right? Where attitudes toward family, community, all sorts of things are approached differently in China in ways that might be foreign to Western audiences as well.
And we don't see much of what's coming out of China. I know with a lot of the streaming services today, you've got a title that sounds rather appealing, and it's coming from a place far away for Netflix and others, but I don't recall ever seeing a Chinese product.
I would look a little closer, because you're right that most Americans are not seeing Chinese films. Today, most of the Chinese films that are released in theaters in the U.S. are released in communities with a high number of Chinese immigrants. Mm. So it's still possible. Like there are a couple theaters here in Los Angeles where I live where it's possible to go see movies that are popular in China at the moment on the big screen. But what's been interesting is that the scale is so massive of everything there that even the Chinese diaspora is a population bigger than most countries. And so streaming services like Netflix is not in China. The Chinese government did not allow Netflix to break into the market because they wanted to protect their own streaming services. Netflix, nonetheless, is still licensing many Chinese films because there are so many Chinese viewers outside of China at this point.
You say that within a decade of the clashes that we talked about in 2008, all kinds of things took place. So I want people to understand that this is not just a casual relationship that has been developed. Universal wanted to complete a $500 million financial deal with a Chinese firm, cast actresses in big movies. MGM would shop itself for a Chinese takeover, and censoring of James Bond movies would take place. Of course, the one that I think comes to mind, for me at least, is Top Gun and the impact on the Top Gun franchise. And you can talk about that because I think symbolically that explains a lot of what we're talking about. But this really is a serious business because, you know, the proceeds that come from a Chinese exhibition of a film can either make or break the film, determine whether it gets made. I mean, this is serious stuff.
Absolutely. And I think that can be surprising to some people. You know, whenever these big movies come out and they make $1.5 or $1.6 billion at the global box office, it can seem like everybody's raking it in. When in reality, oftentimes the films are so expensive to make and market that a China gross can be the difference between profit and loss, even on numbers as big as some of these superhero films' grosses. And you're right that the Top Gun example is such a great one to look at, because obviously the first Top Gun is just such an emblem of what we were discussing at the top of the show about the message of Americana, and not only in so far as it helped boost enlistment numbers in the U.S. Navy after the film came out, but it also boosted sales of Ray-Bans. You know, we go to the movies for several things, and Top Gun accomplished a couple. They got everyone to want to look like Tom Cruise and defend the country like he does too. Then, more than 30 years later, when Paramount is rebooting the film and going to make a sequel, they released some promotional imagery that shows Tom Cruise suited up in his bomber jacket from the original film. The only thing is that the bomber jacket has been altered, and two flags that were on the back of his original costume, Taiwanese flag and a Japanese flag, had been removed. And that was because Chinese financiers on the project said, hey, this movie has a tougher time of getting released in China if those flags are on his jacket. Of course, because China considers Taiwan part of its own territory, mm-hmm. its own borders,
oh, yeah.
and has, you know, decades-long tensions with Japan as well. So they took both of the flags off, and I think that what's important to note is that this new Top Gun film with the altered jacket, it still has not come out yet, and it still hasn't even been submitted for release in China. The flags are being changed preemptively by executives in Los Angeles, not because of any message from Beijing.
You know, that's a really interesting point, which is an executive in China sees something and says, well, we'd really like you to make those North Korean soldiers, not Chinese soldiers who are getting run over, or whatever it might be. But then again, there's the notion that something doesn't even get made because we already have it in our mind, the psychology of the Chinese, knowing full well ahead of time whether they want an export like this or that. And therefore, we either pre-censor or we don't do the film at all if it's got such a high number that requires that Chinese market.
That's right. And it only takes a couple high-profile examples for everybody to absorb the lesson. So in the mid-90s, there were a couple films being made about the young Dalai Lama, and Tibet is, if Taiwan is one third rail of Chinese sovereignty, Tibet is another. And when the films were released by Disney and Sony were temporarily banned from doing any business in China. And so that sends a message to every other studio that wants to maintain access to the market: don't touch the Dalai Lama. And it sends a message to all the other actors who might have been Buddhists or proud supporters of the Dalai Lama, you know, keep your mouth shut. Don't talk about this if you want your movies to be released in China. And so then those are major case studies. But then if you look at the number of movies going into China every year, it only takes a couple years to put together a bit of a data set on what movies will work, what movies won't, what movies have to have certain scenes struck out. And suddenly everybody's got a playbook that they can follow.
Eric Schwartzel is with us. The book is called Red Carpet, and it's really an important discussion. I mean, it really is, because, you know, sometimes you think movies are fluff and fun and so forth. They're an incredible business here in America that's being affected by the need to bring in this Chinese market. And, you know, Eric, we're seeing this not only with films, but we're seeing a lot of this difficult way for us culturally to understand what we're exporting and what we will allow to happen while, of course, whether a movie is being played or whether a basketball game is being played, and we see the backdrop of the politics. And we're beginning to wonder, of course, in the context now of a lot of the sanctioning that's going on with Russia, and we're seeing what's going on with the Uyghurs in China, and we say, do we really want to be a part of this? And to what extent do we want to either change our standards, acquiesce to things that we find objectionable in terms of human rights? I mean, this is a really important topic. Do you think that Americans really are focused enough on this, or even our government, to understand the implications of some of these things?
I think it's changing. I think that you're right. Hollywood was in many ways an early student to a lot of the lessons that all kinds of sectors are learning right now, whether it's tech or sports, as you mentioned, fashion, hospitality, all of these sectors that have spent the last 25 years rushing into China's economy and taking advantage of its massive middle class, they're all realizing that that success has become something of a liability when these tensions rise, or as you said, these human rights abuses come to light. I think for a while, this was a topic that seemed to be mostly the domain of the right, of Republicans. But I have found, even in just, talking to folks in the months since my book has come out, that it is becoming more and more of a bipartisan concern. And there are not a lot of issues that Ted Cruz and AOC agree on. But since, a Western company censoring themselves for China is one thing that they agree is not to be tolerated. I think this din will grow louder and louder. And the Russia news of recent weeks here is another interesting example, because not only does, whenever all these businesses are rushed out of Russia in response to Putin's invasion of Ukraine, there are some folks, it's not really gathering too much steam, but there are some folks that say, well, what about China? Why are you still in China if you're taking such a stance against Putin in Russia? Very different situation because of the severity of Putin's actions. But nonetheless, it does seem like the invasion and then the rush to support Ukraine and President Zelensky has re-engaged a conversation we haven't had in a while, which is the values of the West, the values that certain governments promote and certain kinds of governments promote. And I think that is the conversation that really informs thing about China and Western business.
You say that China's pressure on Hollywood has the potential to challenge the U.S. film industry as the chief narrator of the 21st century. I thought that was a really profound and important point. And again, we cannot understate how important the cultural exportation of the American lifestyle to sell jeans, to sell, America's products around the world, to sell the fact that democracy is something that people should really be able to live under. I mean, these are really important concepts. And yet what we're really doing is we're acknowledging that the greatest competitor or the greatest accessory that we now need to make the movie industry as whole as it can be is someone who is out there wanting to do the exact opposite in terms of their cultural push into this century.
I think you're right, and I think it also depends on where you look, because a lot of the conversation in Hollywood has been around the fact that Chinese movies rarely work in the U.S., and they probably won't work for the foreseeable future. But if you go to other parts of the world where China's influence is really ramped up and really become, frankly, rather ubiquitous in recent years, it's a different story. So I spent some time when I was reporting the book in Kenya, where there has been a massive surge of Chinese investment. I went to Nairobi, and it's not uncommon to see hotels that print receipts in Mandarin. I was driving at one point, and I passed an apartment complex called the Great Wall Apartments that were located off of Beijing Road. Mm-hmm. And then outside Nairobi, there is a program run out of Beijing called the 10,000 Villages Project, which is outfitting 10,000 African villages with low-cost satellite dishes that carry Chinese movies and TV shows. So when you say the chief narrator, I think that's what I think about, is where in other parts of the world are people absorbing certain messages and certain entertainment, and increasingly in Africa, the diet is much more Chinese than it used to be.
And that is by design. Clearly, I've gone to places like the Bahamas and seen incredible investment that's being made by the Chinese there. I mean, they've got that whole movement to drive their economic power across the globe. So it's clearly part of a plan. Let me ask you, you say that U.S. ticket sales are split, I think, roughly 50-50 between the studios and theater operators. What is the business arrangement in China? And I know, like, Spider-Man No Way Home has managed to become a huge success without China. If we finally had to say, look, this is not working, either the censorship that's involved or just the overlording that's going on, or the fact that we in America as capitalists recognize that we can't make a great movie for America if we have to accede to the demands and the wishes of the Chinese as well. And so we just want to make it for America and other, you know, countries that are like-minded. I mean, what happens to the business? What is the business proposition here that we're talking about?
It's a really great question because, I mean, one reason why I think there's been such an exodus out of Russia is because Russia's economy is still pretty minor concern for a lot of companies. Its box office is much smaller than I think most people would expect it to be. When a movie is released in the U.S., studios get about 50 cents of every dollar on a ticket sale. In China, they only get 25%, so it's a smaller share. Nonetheless, it's still an important share, in part because it's almost all profit, because marketing a film in China is either impossible or really cheap. They don't have the expenses that the studios don't have the expenses that they do when releasing a film in the U.S. or in other countries. And so there's that element too. Now, you're right. Spider-Man is at some insane number, like maybe 1.8 billion now worldwide, and it had not been released in China. I would say, though, that Sony, which released the film, certainly would prefer a 2.2 number than a 1.8. And still, nonetheless, when these movies that cost $250 or $300 million are greenlit, they are still done on the hope that they will play in China. It's not necessarily a guarantee, because you have to get past the censors, but it's still so lucrative that you're not going to put anything in that script that's going to challenge it.
Now, you remind us in the book that Chinese theaters were cut off to the world until 1994. Now, what I like also about the book is that you get into the Chinese history, and if you go from Mao Zedong to Deng Xiaoping to Xi now, I mean, you're looking at a pendulum that's going back toward a time when there was a cultural revolution under Mao. So obviously that says all that you need to hear. He would never have allowed in these American films. Then Deng Xiaoping opened up the economy and was a more realistic leader of China. Now we're going back to a much more repressive autocratic approach to things under a leader for life, presumably. So this is having an impact, I would imagine, on the relationship editorially between U.S. movie makers and the Chinese.
It absolutely is. And you're right that Xi Jinping is the most authoritative leader since Mao. And frankly, a lot of studios don't know quite what to do, because last year, there were several films, Spider-Man was one of them, that should have been expected to sail onto Chinese screens, but didn't. And the authorities never let them in. And it's not like a memo comes from Beijing saying, you know, here's why we didn't let your movie in. You just kind of never hear from them. They ghost you in a way, you know. And so it made that relationship more tenuous. And I also think what we've seen with Xi inside China is not just the skepticism of that Western importing, but also an expectation that his film industry will come underfoot and will do his bidding, similar to how artists during Mao's time only made art that served the state. It's not quite as extreme. There's certainly still a commercial industry in China, but we're seeing a real surge in the number of propaganda films being made and the intensity of those propaganda films too.
Now, you say that the entire exercise that you talk about in the book about the red carpet is really a story in three acts. The first act was Hollywood's growth into this powerhouse that pulled the world toward the U.S. The second was Hollywood becoming our biggest export, and the collision that followed, a decade during which Hollywood vulnerabilities met Chinese ambition. And now the third act, the spotlight on China and the industry has become an essential arm of a recast Middle Kingdom. That would seem to be the point where there's going to be real friction. Is that friction playing out in a lot of ways, or is it more subtle now? You just talked about more propaganda films being made by Xi or required by Xi. I mean, where do we go from here?
I think that we're coming to a moment now where there's been this real bifurcation in Hollywood, where there's still major theatrical films being released. Think of films like The Batman, which just came out, or the Harry Potter films that are still coming out this year, the Marvel films. These are still going to be major theatrical films that are going to, if not need China, then certainly really, really want it. On the other hand, COVID has accelerated an industry-wide pivot towards streaming, which relies less and less on China because it's more about the subscription model. So there's a bit of a bifurcation, one of which gives China more leverage and the other which gives China less.
What about the taste in films overall? I mean, what about our films do the Chinese seem to like? Do they like the same things that Americans like, or is there a particular genre that works really well here, rom-coms or whatever it may be, but won't work over in China?
Well, rom-coms are difficult, in part because of what we were discussing when it comes to cultural differences. And and so a lot of times if you watch some of these movies, you see that so much of the humor often will rely on an understanding of, you know, Western stereotypes or knowledge and things like that. So those are tricky. Really what has worked best in China for Hollywood are the movies that you can't get anywhere else. And these are still the big, super, you know, special effects laden spectacles that Marvel specializes in, the Fast and the Furious. These are still movies that no other market can make at the scale and sophistication that Hollywood does. And so that's what Chinese audiences have flocked to more than anything.
Of late, China hasn't granted access to many major Hollywood films. There was a report that Woody Allen's romantic comedy, A Rainy Day in New York, which is now somewhat old, I mean, it's 3 or 4 years old. So what's happening now? And are they beginning to say, you know, maybe we can recreate some of these Big Bang films. We don't need America. They would love, as you say, to dominate so many markets like Africa, their own, many in Asia, I would imagine. So tell us what preemption may be going on by the Chinese themselves without the Americans really participating directly. They're saying, we've got it. We'll take it from here.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I would say we're in a moment right now where China is paying a lot of attention to the calibration, because the Hollywood films that are released in China still do very well. And imagine if you're running a movie theater in China, you probably want the Hollywood films because they sell a lot of tickets. Now, there's always been a concern in China that the American films grow too popular. So that is why there's a limit on the number allowed in. That is why they don't let American films in during really popular movie-going times in China. They always have these limits. They've always put these controls on just how popular and successful American imports can be, because they never wanted to appear as though their people prefer American films to Chinese films. Mm. So there's always been that calibration. However, the economics make that difficult because, as I said, you're leaving a lot of money on the table when you don't let in a Spider-Man. So what we've seen now is this kind of this spigot that will be loosened and tightened, depending on how much money needs to come in and also how well Chinese films are doing vis-a-vis American films. So right now we're actually in a moment where there's some relative optimism because China just recently gave release dates to The Batman and several other major Hollywood films that are coming out later this year. That is giving some optimism that things might be turning to some kind of normalcy after last year really seemed like some major wall came up.
And was there a reason specifically for those walls having come up at that time? Because, of course, we participated, well, fully, in a sense, in the Olympics. I mean, was there something that occurred other, obviously, than the pandemic and some in America really kind of putting that on the Chinese themselves and the government? So tell us what might have occurred there and why you think it may be loosening a little bit.
Well, there's a lot of theories. There's no explanation. But one theory is that China was celebrating some significant anniversary last year of the Communist Party. And so oftentimes during those moments or when there's a big world event like the Olympics, Chinese leaders in the past have shut off Western influence because I think the theory goes if you can make people see more Chinese entertainment, they'll feel more pride about being Chinese. And so that's happened in the past where you've seen this kind of tightening anytime they want to bolster internal support or patriotism. And so that is the leading theory. And then the other is that China became the number one box office in 2020 whenever COVID shut down the American theaters. The theaters in China reopened far quicker. And so the other theory is that now that China's number one, they can worry a little bit less about letting those outside, more successful films in.
In closing, are there any American players in our major film studios who basically said more is better, more relations with China, and we'll do whatever you want, we'll change scripts, we'll change emblems on Tom Cruise, whatever it is, or others who've said, no, I'm not going to do that? Have we had those who've been more recalcitrant?
You know, it's interesting. I would say it depends on when you talk to them. I think a lot of folks who are in the seats of power at the studios view this as a market reality. In colder terms, maybe even a fiduciary duty to do as much business in China as possible. Others, whenever they leave those jobs, will often say to you, you know, between you and me, I feel like we really got played and we rushed in a little blinded by the revenue prospects and a little blinded by the fact that we could make our quarterly numbers and turn a profit on these big expensive movies. And now here we are more unsure than ever and at odds with our own government. I mean, that's not a position you ever want to be in as a Western business executive. And so I think it depends on when you talk to them, but nonetheless, I have to say, despite everything that's happened, even in the past couple of weeks here on the world stage, I think there's still a sense that China is too big to ignore and that you still can't do anything that will really jeopardize losing that access.
Well, it's difficult to imagine, but if, in fact, the Chinese did decide to try to, in their minds, reincorporate Taiwan, it would be very fascinating to see what spigot gets shut off and how quickly. I would imagine this would be one, given the relationship that China and the U.S. have, whether Americans understand it or not. It's pretty dramatic, as you have presented here today on our podcast. So, Eric, I want to thank you so much. Eric Schwartzel, the book is called Red Carpet, Hollywood, China, and the Global Battle for Cultural Supremacy. Thanks for being with us today on America Trends.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.